Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Third Rail Politics, a show where we discuss hot political topics that overflow into your personal experiences. I'm Jenny McDaniel, one of your hosts, and here with us we have Sonia Spirit. Sonia, how are you doing?
Hello, I am doing very well, Miss Jenny. Thank you for asking, and I'm glad to know that you are doing well as well. And yes, and our topic today will be about the Second Amendment, school shootings, and personal responsibility.
I love it. Those are some juicy topics. How do you want to start us off? Where do you think we should dig in?
Well, I mean, let's just start with the Second Amendment, because that's usually where everything centers around once the catastrophe takes place. So, and you know, I thought it was going to be a lot, lengthy, but it's not. It's really short, and that's why I guess it is subject to interpretation. But the Second Amendment of the United States Constitution reads, "A well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed."
So, you know, I didn't do a lot of research on the Second Amendment. I did do some research on the school shootings portion, but I, hearing it like that, I can see how it can be taken into different interpretations. What do you get out of it?
I mean, and the thing about the law is you got the letter of the law, you have the spirit of the law, and then you have, when it's vague, then you have it subject to the judge or whoever is exercising their discretion at the time, their interpretation. And it's that lack of clarity or flexibility in meaning is where everyone kind of get lost. So, but you know, for the most part, most people galvanize, you know, you cannot take away my gun. Okay. Mm-hmm. Basically, I am protected. I am a people, you know, that, and that's another argument. You know, I've actually spoken to true historians of like, you know, the United States history, and it's like, well, people were defined back then. Well, you know, who are these people? You know, what does people mean? Because people is an all-encompassing word, mm-hmm. you know. It does, yeah. So it's just interesting because, well, that's another story, but and that's another topic. But, yes, yeah, so you have, you know, in order to – so the and the part about the militia is that the people are the ones, the everyday citizens are the ones who will do the protecting, okay? And they are the ones who will also institute the militia when it is time. So time defines the regulated militia. It's not just an organization of people because, now this is just one interpretation, that the militia was a band of regular citizens, you know, me and you and our neighbors, and we would take up arms when the time presented itself when we had to defend our security or our free state or whatever it is that needed to be defended, okay? So that's why the people have the right to keep and bear arms. So that's why. So it's not like, you know, you have militia groups that all they do is, you know, whatever it is that their task is. I don't want to say necessarily what they do, but whatever it is that their mission, their purpose. But militia defined in this sense at this particular period were just regular everyday people, citizens, you know, so.
It's so interesting, the gun culture in America. You're right. There's a big, big group of people out there who are gun crazy. You can't take my guns. Don't look at my guns. And I find it interesting the type of people that these generally tend to be. And they're all over the country. But when I lived in the South in Chattanooga, Tennessee, I ran across it pretty intense down there in the red states. And I was like, this is a very interesting dynamic. So who placed this fear into this culture of it's going to be taken away? And is that how it stokes the hate and anger. Because as far as I can see, I don't think anyone's in jeopardy of getting their guns taken away. A little bit of regulation, maybe. But I don't see our government, A, being able to get it, get them all from us, or the American people handing them over. And the funny thing is, the gun culture people are very, very interested in keeping a lot of arms so that they can fight our own government when it comes down to it. Now, in my mind, I'm a radical, and I think that's an admirable trait. But what I don't think these people understand is the amount of technology our government actually has is astronomical. Your shotgun isn't going to stand up to sound wave weapons that are not exposed to the public. What we've got is their old stuff. So I just think it's interesting that there's a big fight around keeping the guns to protect us from a government that would just smear us if they wanted to. So, but I don't think they want to. I think that they know that we've grown and grown as a people in this country, and we've got a certain type of temperament, and there's no way we would stand for the government saying no guns. We wouldn't allow it to happen. But it's all just very interesting. And what do you think about the Constitution and how it's written? Do you think that, this is a touchy subject, but do you think we should kind of reword that a bit? Do you think it's a bit confusing that you're using words like militia? Because it's kind of got a little different, that word's got a little different frequency right now. We often think of renegade, outlaw, dangerous people in the word militia.
Who do you trust to change the wording?
I don't know. It's all someone's ego filtering it through, and I guess that maybe, you know, there would be a voting on it or something. I don't know.
But then think about this. And even if we could come together and agree upon new language that appeared to clarify any ambiguity, this language will be obsolete in another 100 years anyway.
Yep.
So you know, to an extent, it's a living document. So you either have to it either has to continue to breathe, which means it will be subject to iterations and change, okay, by the dogma, if you will, of that era, or you can let it stand the test of time, and which is why it probably is in its most simplistic form. You know what I mean? But you have to, now this is where I think we fall short as people, I guess. You have to remember, like you said, when this was written and how the word militia has changed. However, when you read it, you have to read it from that perspective, that era, that mindset. The word militia is actually capitalized, so, and it, you know, it's in the middle of a sentence, a well-regulated militia, okay, the M is capitalized, being necessary to the security of a free state, the word state is capitalized, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, and the word arms is capitalized, and these words are right before a comma, so they're not the beginning of a sentence, they're generally at the end of a clause or phrase. But it's just one, it's only one sentence with about four phrases or clauses. But anyway, the language I think needs to remain simplistic or in its original context, because at least we have the luxury of knowing at this particular time what was going through these particular people's mind, or perhaps we can think we do, much better than if it continues to change. Because eventually it will change, you know, you will manipulate it into something kind of like the Supreme Court panel now. You know, you can manipulate it to be swayed either way when you're able to change it. And so you lose its original meaning, you could lose its continuity, its original function. So, yeah, I would be reluctant to change this document. However, to be quite honest, I think we all need to get to a point where we don't even need to be governed by such documents, but that's another story entirely.
In another time frame continuum. Yeah, that's like 100 years from now, maybe 150, maybe 1,000, something, you know, there will, I think, be a space and time where this will be kind of put in a museum and, you know, looked back on and like, look, humans used guns and we don't use them anymore. And, you know, we'll see. We'll see how it all goes. But yeah, the wording and the age and the space that we were in when the Constitution was written in 1700s, I mean, it's just wildly different, just like the Bible compared to now.
Right. Yes.
And they have kept the Bible over 2,000 years, and it's, well, I guess we'll call it its original form, but certainly it's been translated and it's lost a little bit of probably wording in the translations and such along the time. But yeah, I can see the benefit of keeping something in its original form, but I can also see the benefit of altering and shifting such intense documents to fit the time that it sits. But then you fall back on, like your beautiful question, who do we trust to change the wording? So, you know, I don't think we're at a place where we can trust anyone to change the wording. So I'm going to stick with you and say, let's just keep the original document for right now.
Yes, because that really is the biggest question. Who do you trust to change the wording? And, you know, I mean, whether it's a panel of people, you know, because it's hard to find altruism. You know what I mean? Everyone has an agenda, you know, and can we collectively get together and have an agenda that is for the betterment of all? I mean, because if we could, you know, if that could be the purpose, if that could be the agenda, then that would be great. But, you know, if the
you
ego
don't see it right now.
Well, no, because you'd have to have a variety of leaders. They can't all be political. They can't, you know, you need a variety of leaders. So you can't even just have like a panel of 10 people because they need to represent different genres or different, you know what I mean? That you need some to represent economics, some to represent different cultures, you know, international cultures, monetary, education. I mean, there's so many things that factor into, you know, when you want to start modifying a document, even something as simple as the Second Amendment, because it extends into a lot of economics alone. You know, the gun company gets upset every time there's a change made, and then they find a new way of selling their guns. Now, I'm not knocking the gun industry. It is an industry because, in my opinion, the sickness lies with the person, not with the tool.
Agreed. Yeah, that when I did a little bit of research, of course, Columbine came up and a lot of stuff around mental illness came up. Mm-hmm. So when we're ready, we'll segue into some ideas about the school shootings and the psychology behind it. And maybe we can even throw around a few ideas of what could fix it. I'm fascinated by the Second Amendment. And I want to ask you, though, do you have anything else you want to talk about with the Second Amendment?
No, I think, you know, I think we kind of touched on everything because, like I said, it's concise. In terms of brevity, not in terms of clarity, but, you know, so no, I think we've kind of massaged it as much as we can. And if there's any further information to add, we can put it in context as we continue the conversation.
Cool. Yeah, maybe we can do a wrap up at the end and cover anything that might have been left behind. But yeah, just to clarify, I feel like even though I'm a peaceful person, I do feel the significance of protection from the invaders of the home and to be able to hunt. I feel like we should always have the right to bear arms, and I do feel like a little bit of regulation can sit on there. Are you do you approve of gun ownership, Sonia?
Yeah, I don't have a problem with it. Like I said, it's because in my opinion, it is just a tool.
Mm-hmm.
It is the idea, the thought, the energy, the force behind it is what makes it such a deadly weapon.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, I mean, the same thing with a kitchen knife, but we're not worried about, you know, well, at least I'm not worried being in an elevator, somebody's going to stab me, you know what I'm saying, randomly. I don't have that same fear, and I wonder why, but that's a different story too. But it's not. It does fall into context with this. But so as far as bearing arms, like, okay, me personally, no, I don't have a gun. I've never owned a gun. And the reason why is because when I was younger, I always thought if I had one, I would probably use it. And I don't want to go to jail. mm-hmm. for killing anyone, you know, because I wasn't good at holding my temper, you know. So I know I've never owned one, but my dad's owned them. He was a hunter, and he was also a over the long distance truck driver. So he had a pistol for protection. My mom in her 60s, late 60s, became a licensed carrier, you know. And so, so I don't knock anyone. I'm not one of those people like, oh, guns kill, blah, blah, blah. No, let's get to the root of the, you know, to the issue. Mm-hmm. So, no, I don't have a problem with people owning guns. I want us to get to a point where we no longer need them or they're no longer a symbol of security.
That'd be beautiful. I'm voting for that. I'm holding out for that space and time too. And then in my research, I do feel, like you said, the gun is a tool, and the person using it, whether they're healthy psychologically or not healthy psychologically, bears all the difference of how they use that tool. And that can be used as far as a knife or a fork or a stick or anything. So just the other week, I was watching the news with my boyfriend, and there was a stabbing in London. I think it was London. And I go, oh boy, all the pro-gun people are going to be like, do you see? You can still kill people even when guns aren't legal or not around or except in the city or however they have it set up there. And I thought, you know, yeah, that's true. Angry people do kill people with their fists, with anything. Mm-hmm. But you don't kill 12 people at once with your fists. You know what I mean? You don't kill 12 people at once with a knife unless you're just, you know, got them all trapped in a room and stuff. It's interesting.
You do bomb them and you do run over them. So there are other weapons of mass destruction other than a gun. Because if the intent is there to destroy, to harm, to hurt, listen, whether they have access to a gun or not, because it's not the method, it's not the means. Now, because you have more sickos here and, you know, you have more unhealthy people. I don't want to call them sickos because that is so derogatory. But because you have so many people who are mentally unhealthy, because they do have easy access to guns. But the thing is, it's still not the gun. It's the disease. It's the fear. It's what, you know, and it is some of it is mental health. Some of it is fear because there are innocent people get killed with guns too. You know, a kid might pick up one, accidentally found it because it's not locked, you know, but it's not, you know, why is the gun present? That's like I said, it's still not the gun. Why is the gun present?
You know, and there's a lot of talk, and I don't know how I feel about all of it. I haven't sat on one side or the other, but there's a lot of talk about, and I may say the wording wrong because I'm not a huge gun knower, but I think it's automatic weaponry. They're saying that, you know, there's no need for that for hunting or defending your home. What do you think about that? Do you feel like there should be or shouldn't be automatic guns? I guess that's what you call them.
I think, once again, focusing on automatic guns is a diversionary tactic for not addressing the mental illness behind wanting to kill anyone, another human being. It's a slippery slope. Okay, so I can see the argument both ways. People who want to hold on to their guns, yes, it's a slippery slope argument where, yes, they take away the automatic weapons, then they'll find another reason why you don't need this and why you don't need that, and this will be illegal, and next thing you know, you will be armless. And there's some documentary that basically talked about different dictatorships and how they killed and was able to oppress their people because they were not armed. I get that aspect. And like I said, I'm not for or against them either way. It's a tool. A credit card can be used to fly to a funeral, you know, of your best friend. And so that is using it for good. Or you can use it to jimmy open a door and stab somebody to death or suffocate them with their own pillow. Is the credit card evil? Is it the evil tool? No. And that's the same way we need to look at guns. Guns are not the evil tool. Like I said, I don't own one. I'm not a proponent of buying one. But it's not the evil tool. It's the diseased mind. So let's stop, misdirecting other people's attention. But by the same token now, these diseased minds, and when I say disease, we're all diseased. I'm diseased as well. So don't think I'm talking about people below us. We all have some issues that we need correction on. Okay. But it is it's the diseased mind that needs healing. You know, we don't want to be in a point where we think our only choice, you know, is to destroy another human being. Now, I get the part about home invasions, but even then, okay, I don't want to go down this path, but we have to bear in mind, and for people who are, because we are in the age of Aquarius, so, you know, eventually we can kind of introduce some of these concepts, but listen, bad things are not just happening to people. I'm not a fan of randomness. So there are no accidents, no happenstance, no coincidences, even though there appears to be. Okay. And if we want to change the way we feel about guns, we're going to have to change the way we see our reality.
Yeah, you know, on one of my other podcasts, The Alchemy Sisters, we often talk about where we can get to the root of this mental illness, this disease, this illness. Where do we start? You know, and what we've come up with, and we banter back and forth every once in a while about this topic because we're all about finding cures and fixing things up. In my mind, I see a lot more psychological health in schools. So if I had it my way, I would take some of that war fundage money, a percentage, not all of it for God's sakes, and I would employ every social worker and licensed therapist, and hell, maybe even life coach if they got some serious skill. I would hire them all and put them in the schools. I feel like there's a lot of ways we can come at this. This is one of them, I feel like, when you get to the young and you have more eyes rather than one teacher with, 25 students? She's got to keep her eye on them and her back's to them half the time, writing on the board or however they do it these days. You know, it's just, we're failing in that space, I feel like. I've decided not to have children in this lifetime because of the fear around the institutions and how they're ran, and I don't trust myself to homeschool. So I feel like we could get a big chunk of that illness exposed and treated before it gets too bad if we have a lot more psychological workers and maybe just eyes. Maybe they can be assistants on these kids when they start showing some symptoms of mental illness. Now, I read an article yesterday that said a very, very, very small percentage of mentally ill people go on rampage with guns. So getting to the bottom of typical mental illness to this destruction, hateful, space. There's clearly a difference between typical teenage depression and this hatred that somehow is built up. In the article I read, it was kind of leaning toward abuse and a tough childhood. And it's interesting that a lot of us can be abused and have tough childhoods and not go shoot things up. So getting to the bottom of what separates, what happens there. And then you get the professionals on it. This country is wicked smart. We've got so much skill here. Let's put our people to work and start figuring shit out. We've got engineers. We got scientists. We've got professional doctors.
And I hear you. I hear you. And I think we can do something maybe even more simpler immediately.
Like?
Meditation in schools. Mm-hmm. There are studies that have been done on early education students, school children, where it increases their concentration, it boosts their confidence, it decreases their like energy level where they're not anxious, more just kind of calm, at rest, at peace. and this is something that, you could probably already find a teacher in the school who does yoga. You know what I mean? So you could start, it's a matter of reallocating your current resources. The first thing I would, the first thing in the morning, you have homeroom or whatever it is, gather everyone into the auditorium, whether it's for 15 minutes, whatever you want to do it for, and just teach mindful meditation. Start the practice now. Get them in the habits now. And, of course, this is something that they should be also teaching as far as, new parents, everyone. We should all, as a country, as a collective spiritual group. Start incorporating something as simple as free. As free, we get so caught up in budgets and we can't afford to do this. We don't even try anymore. Let me give you a great example of how we don't even try anymore. We don't even try. We already equipped and armed with the excuses. Real small example. Today, so the batteries in my remote control are going dead. So some of the functionality doesn't always work. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. But every time I always try to say a command to change the channel just using my voice, it gives me that little sound like it's not going to do it. Well, today, I didn't even bother. I just went through the guide and went all the way down until I found the channel. And then, of course, the universe said, you didn't even try. And not that it said it in a shameful way, but it's like bringing it to my attention. You didn't even try to use the button or the function because of your past experiences. And I was like, yes, it was interesting. And then it countered it with me trying to get onto Skype for this program. Remember I told you I was locked out. Microsoft gave me a hard time. I basically blocked them from my email so they can't even help me get it fixed. But I was determined to get Skype fixed, and it wasn't as difficult as I thought it was. And just because I tried, and I knew that I was going to get it fixed because I knew there were things dependent on it. So I didn't know how it was going to get done, but I knew I was going to get it done. And it was easier than I thought. And I paralleled the two experiences and realized that my attitude determined the outcome in both instances.
I would love to see whole schools meeting in the auditorium for a 15-minute focus in or meditation space. I think that would be wonderful. When I went to massage therapy school 17 years ago, the first semester we did yoga every morning, and I wouldn't have done it unless I was made to do it on my own. And when I was made to do it for class, I realized that there's so much benefit, and now I love to do yoga. I don't do it every day, but I do it quite often, and I enjoy it. And so I do feel like just setting the pace, 15 minutes in the morning, and then maybe even 15 minutes in the evening or afternoon. It costs nothing.
That's right.
And I think that's a brilliant way that we can get that energy moving that can happen before we start employing mental health practitioners. Absolutely. And then, you know, this is what I would imagine. Like you said, we're already going to be armed with excuses. So if I were to bring this to the table to somebody who could change something, they would probably say something like, well, we need 7 hours a day to get our funding. And if we don't do 7 hours a day of classes,
yeah.
So we're pushing up against government and regulation. And then how do we kind of soften that and get that to move around a little bit? There are studies. It is on paper. It is documented that it works. It's proven that it, you know, clears the mind, releases anxiety, clears stresses. But how do we get to the people who get to call the shots and convince them? It's sad that we have to convince them to help us save our lives.
A grassroots effort.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you broadcast the message globally, but you get the work done locally.
Yes. I love it.
So it would have to be a grassroots effort. Each school needs to demand it. We need to get to the point where we are fed up as a people. Everyone is looking for leadership. Be your own leader. We are all personally responsible. If you want something changed, be the change agent. We talk about it all the time, especially people in the metaphysical, the esoteric, you know, spiritual people, all the time. The change begins with you. So if we want to see it done, you know, if you have children in that school, then you already have a vested interest to want that change to occur. You know, this isn't just about your child meditating at home. You want the whole energy of the school to change from competition to cooperation, you know, from resistance to looking for to creativity. Creativity is a proactive move of change. You know, you are we won't go here on the spiritual note, but that's what life is all about. Life is all about growth. expansion. And there's also a cyclical component. We see it in nature every season.
And maybe we can even bypass getting it accepted into schools right away, or we can start doing that grassroots movement, but then also get the parents in on doing it at home, whether it's before dinner, after dinner, before we go to bed, when we wake up in the morning, getting a little routine going at home. And I think that the parents see a difference when their kid gets to focus in and do some meditation, because I'm sure that the results ripple out at home with their behaviors and their attitudes and what have you. So it would be cool to even, yes, get the grassroots movement to get the schools to shift and change their schedules a bit, and then also opening up the space and having a global movement of, hey, now parents are having their kids do it at home for 15 minutes until we can get it in schools, and then even adding more time when we get into schools, do it a little at home and at schools. Because what I think will happen, and it's just because I get into these debate sections in social media, so I know there's always a rebuttal on the other side. What you might have then are the religious people saying, well, we can't say the Pledge of Allegiance anymore or have a Bible in class. Why do you get to sit our kids down for 15 minutes and meditate? That's Buddhist, or that's Hindu, or that's not American, or whatever. So do you think we would get a lot of kickback from, let's just even say, just religious parents about meditation?
Probably. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, it is a choice. Listen, we need volunteers. You know what I mean? We need volunteers. We're trying to build some positive energy for a healthy learning environment, but a healthy growth environment. You know, our cells divide all the time, and they divide. They respond to the energy that they're in. You know, we don't even think about, because we don't think about disease. We think disease is caused by, you know, food and no exercise. That's not the whole story. So, you know, and if we are trying to change the energy. Now, if someone doesn't want to do it, that's fine. That's fine. There should always be an alternative, because, you know, this planet is based on polarity, so, and it's freedom of choice. And we, like I said, we want people to want to do this. And as people see other people benefit, then they're less inclined to, you know, not get on board. But if there's resistance, let there be resistance. But let them be pushed, just resistant against themselves. You know, Bruce Lee wrote a beautiful book, and I have never read the whole thing, but so don't quote me on it. But just based on his concepts, he was teaching martial arts on how to use your opponent's energy against himself. And I don't mean that, you know, to defeat someone, but what I'm saying is allow people to express themselves and then allow them to be able to see that there is a difference. You know, people are so used to being combative that your way is wrong, my way is right. No, if that's how you feel, then you go with that. And you continue to go with it until you autocorrect. And if you never autocorrect, then that's your experience. And I'm not going to hold that against you. But there are a lot of people that are getting on this energy train that do want to make a difference. And those are the people that we want to get involved.
Absolutely. You know, in my readings, I came across some common denominators that these school shooters would have. And I thought maybe we could look at some of the psychology behind that. One of which was they were often students of the schools that they attacked, and often noting that some of them, and I think a majority of them, had been bullied or outcasted. So just looking at that, and we'll go into the other significance in a second, let's just stop here. Do you think there's always been bullying in schools, and do you think it's gotten worse, or do you think that people's resistance and resilience to it has gone down, or what do you think about them associating being bullied with the attack?
There's always been bullying. Now, is it everywhere? I won't say that it's everywhere, but it's certainly, you know, widespread. And because you have to take into consideration what bullying really is, if you think about it, think about what bullying really is. It's a sign of insecurity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, And I'm sure there have been insecure people all, you know, that expand, you know, the range of time, like a Napoleon complex, you know.
Yep.
we've heard about people's insecurities, or what was it, the bigger the man's car, blah, blah, blah,
mm-hmm.
you know. Exactly. Okay, so, which is another expression of insecurity. So, yes, I think there has always been bullying, because bullying is a term used in the school concept. But think about domestic violence. That's bullying,
mm-hmm.
you
oh,
know?
Sure.
Yeah. So, you know, it's always been around. Whenever you have a relationship where one person wants to be dominant, you
mm-hmm.
know, or in control, and then the second person either resists and move on or agrees to be the submissive, whether, you know. And when I say agree, I know that we'll get some feedback for that. But listen, everybody plays a role. You know, I'm not a believer in victims. So everybody plays a role. But part of it, too, is because of conditioning. So that's where we're getting at. So getting back to the psychology of the shooters, or the, you know, what that particular environment. Yes, there is some insecurity there. There is some mental defect of some kind, you know.
Yeah, they were pairing it with depression and paranoia. So depression's one thing, and then you add the level of paranoia to it, and it distorts into a whole other ball game.
Yeah, and see, all of those, you know, but those are just, like, in my opinion, they're just, you know, different tags for expression, so to speak, you know, because it's all kind of just distorted energy. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, however you want to choose to describe it. So it's like, let's peel behind the onion, or peel down the onion, and find out what's behind all of this distorted or diseased energy. You know, go ahead.
Very interesting. You know, I was looking a little bit at some of two shooters at Columbine. I watched the Michael Moore documentary a long time ago. I
mm-hmm.
get it mixed up with some of the other documentaries I've watched, but it was interesting, the dynamics between the two shooters, Eric and Dylan. Dylan was the bullied, pushed around, outcasted individual that snapped, and Eric was the sociopath. You know, just really hateful for no good reason, had been like that for a long time. So I was interested in the dynamics of the difference of those two shooters that actually even worked together in that shooting in 1999. So one of them was an empath, what appeared to be an empath gone bad, so to speak, flipped over the other end. And the other one was a narcissist, already on the bad path, going deeper down. So two different spaces, one being generally a heartful individual, and the other one always kind of being a douchebag from the sounds of it.
Yeah, but the thing is, you know, we attract people, and there are many facets to our being. So even though, and all of us, whether we know it or not, you know, scientists will tell you, but, you know, all of us are like holograms of the universe. So everything is encapsulated within us. We are capable of anything at any given time under the right circumstances, whether we choose to believe it or not. So with Dylan and Eric, you know, now Eric, of course, he's been consistent in his identity. Okay,
mm-hmm.
so he's not the variable. The variable is Dylan.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like you said, he was an empath, and at some point in time, I don't want to say he lost his way, but he chose an experience
yep.
that of course comes with a lot of karmic debt,
yep.
unhealthy karmic debt. I'll put it that way, unhealthy karmic debt. So that part is interesting, and of course from a psyche, the word psyche means soul anyway. So when we talk about psychology, we're talking about, you know, the soul, the conscious and the subconscious, more so the subconscious than the conscious. But so that's what psyche means. So at some point, you know, because our psyche is dynamic. So with Dylan, at some point in time, his psyche, the dynamics of his psyche, chose a different path. And whatever was taking place in his environment supported that choice, good, bad, or indifferent. You know what I'm saying? So there could be variables going on at home where he's not receiving enough love, or maybe he doesn't know who, you know, he doesn't have a comfortable identity. I mean, there are so many components, because the human mind, the human being, is a very complex entity or component or whatever you want to call it, structure. So yeah, I think those two are interesting, but yeah, and that's like you said, that's getting into one psychological facet. There are so many others though, you know, because they're not always children. You have adults who hold the children hostage, you know.
The first I've ever heard of mass public shootings when I was a kid. I was growing up in the 80s. There was even a term for it, going postal. You know, you hear of the adults freaking out at their jobs, and it happened to maybe happen several times in a post office, so it got the rap or whatever. I'm sure it happens in every genre or walk of life or work style. But going postal. So, yeah, adults losing their shit and shooting up their workplace.
Yes. And, but just looking at school shootings, you're right, because that's the psychology before then. And even just, like you said, doing research on it, and I know Wikipedia is not, you know, the end-all to be-all in terms of credibility, but, you know, they have lists of school shootings, you know, in the 19th century, the 20th century, and the 21st century. So they have them by lists of centuries in the United States, which, of course, lets you know that this is not an uncommon phenomena, you know, even when we first came on our radar in 1999 with the Columbine, that wasn't even the first one that took place in Littleton, Colorado in the last 20 years, I think. I think there was another one in the 80s that I don't recall hearing anything about, but then again, I was much younger, so I wouldn't have been paying attention to the news.
You know, that's what they went into in some of my readings is, you know, Columbine, really the media hit hard with it. It was everywhere, and then they actually got a bunch of copycats. So they were saying, at what point do we have freedom of speech, and at what point do we hinder it a bit so there's not copycats? Now, I'm all about giving out the information. Surely things can get over sensationalized, but certainly we need the news. Certainly we need to know what's going on. But what they decided to do with that, of course, they can't just not tell us. It goes against our rights. But what they were trying to do is not name them, because one of the things that they ran across in the common denominators of these shooters is a lot of them wanted infamy or fame. So if they don't say their name in these shootings on the media right away, at least what they thought was we could quench some of that copycat energy. What do you think about that?
Well, as far as not releasing information because you're concerned about copycat, that to me, there's no, that's an unfounded fear. You know, if someone's going to do something crazy, they're going to do it anyway, you know, and whether you, the energy, if it attracts you, it's going to attract. So, you know, not publishing or not sensationalizing it, because I don't think these others were copycats. If you look at these laundry lists of school shootings, I think all they had to do was just broadcast more that were already taking place. There's a lot of these school shootings. Like I said, if you go through Wikipedia, because they have the dates, they have the cities and states. They let you know how many people were killed, how many people were injured, and, like, you know, maybe two or three sentences of, you know, what happened, the person's name, the school, stuff like that. So I don't think that, you know, that these are necessarily copycats. I wouldn't be quick to use that language. And we have to be mindful of language, too. It's so easy to start categorizing things, because what we do is we categorize them, and then we kind of file them away, okay? So when we turn these other incidents into copycats, it's almost like they become devalued, like, well, this would have never happened if it wasn't for this. That's not true. That's not true, or you certainly don't know that to be true. They're just reporting more of what's been happening the whole gosh darn time.
Yeah. Yeah, and then, you know, it kind of goes in with it. Less of a copycat and more of a mental illness or a sickness that just got more exposure. And that's how we heal things. It's unpleasant to expose things like pedophilia and school shootings. But in order to get to the bottom of it, we have to look at all angles and expose it and admit that it's happening and it's a major problem.
That's right, and understand why it's occurring. See, that's the whole thing. We're so ashamed of being a sick society. No, we need to expose the sickness so we can heal and everyone can get better. That's what we need to do. So with the school shootings, you know, that these kids are crying out for help.
Yes.
In one way or another, these adults are crying. Everyone, whoever's shooting is crying out for help. These people are crying out for help. Just like over on the other side of the world, you have suicide bombers. These people are, and they're fighting over things that they actually, you know, convictions, principles in their minds and hearts, okay? Versus like school shootings just seem frivolous because, you know, there is no cause involved, but there is a cause. We just don't want to acknowledge the cause. You know, the cause is a mental illness, mental disease. We keep trying to put a Band-Aid on cancer. It's not going to work.
There's a psychologist, John Van Driel. He's a director at Salem Kaiser Public Schools in Oregon. He states that mental health issues don't cause school shootings. After all, only a tiny, tiny percent of kids with psychological issues go on to become school shooters. So he's claiming, and I haven't read a lot of his stuff, but he's claiming the mental illness isn't the issue because only a small percentage go out to shoot, and that maybe it's a different factor. What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, what does he say is? I mean, is it the gun's fault? I mean, what is he saying is? If he's saying mental health is not the issue, then what is? What argument is he offering? Because I would have to hear it to make the comparison. And if he's not offering one, then okay, then that's just his opinion.
Right, and that's why I was like, in this opinion is. And
yeah.
Because I can see where he's coming from, just like when you were saying the gun is a tool, the person is the perpetrator, the illness in it. And then he's coming at it from a different angle, being like, it's not the mental illness because only some mentally ill people do this. So I would accept both things being an issue here, as well as maybe there is another root that sits below mental illness, and we don't have to categorize it or call it or anything, but maybe it's a certain style of mental illness that we can examine more closely.
Oh, you're not going to find, well, see, that's probably part of the problem. The word mental illness is a category.
Yes, it
okay.
is. Huge.
Yes, mm-hmm. Or a classification. So the motives underneath these, you know, or mental, I mean, because you can say some of them are neurological, some of them are psychological, some of them are, you know, it doesn't matter what category you put them in, because at the end of the day, you still have to get back to the root of whatever it is, whether it's something from an experience in this lifetime that they can recall and connect to and hopefully can recover from fast, or is it from a previous lifetime, which they have no recollection of and probably have no belief in, and as a result, will continue to identify themselves as a victim or a perpetrator instead of a learning experience or growing experience because of how they identify their version of physical reality. So, I mean, he can say it's not a mental health issue, but then if it is not, because we're looking at, you know, we're not looking at animals pulling out guns. We're looking at human beings pulling out guns, okay? So, if it's not some form of mental health, like I said, I don't want to use it as like it's just one size fits all. If it is not some form of mental disharmony, dis-ease, if it is not, then what is it?
The same psychologist, John Van Driel, out of Oregon there, thinks that because these individuals had been struggling alone, either because they were unable to ask for help or their cries went unheard when the adults in their lives didn't realize the child needed support. Certainly, he said a lot more in that article, and I just wrote down a couple quips here, but he's saying that, you know, these children went unsupported and it went into an extreme scarcity or delusional space from the sounds of it.
Okay, so listen, he actually just supported our argument, okay? Everything that he described, the not having support, not having someone to speak to, that is dis-ease mm-hmm. that stems from the mind. See, you know, when people hear the word dis-ease, they're looking for something with a name that they can blame. Cancer, you know, brain tumor.
No. Autoimmune, yeah,
right.
With all of them.
Right, but let me tell you how important love and support, that type of energy in your environment. Anybody who's, they've done experiments with water, where you treat water one way or rice one way in water and rice another way in water. You treat one with love, support, adoration, all kinds of harmonious energy. You treat the other one, they have examples of this, YouTube. You treat the other one with disdain, loathing, detest. And the difference in the waters is night and day. Energy matters. Stop fooling yourself, people.
You know, there was that Japanese dude who wrote the book, The Power of Water, or The Energy, or The Life of Water. I can't remember exactly what the title was. But yes, he would take some water and he'd put all kinds of energy and love and harmony toward it. And the other one would have a lot of hate and anger, and it just filled that water with that same energy. And they used the water to water different plants. The love harmony water plant was beautiful. The hate despair water plant was unhealthy and half dead. Mm-hmm. And the idea is our bodies are what, 68% water or more? So if talking to water in a healthy manner is beneficial, then it would be beneficial to our bodies because we're mostly water.
That's exactly where I'm going. When a baby is born, it's 100% water. By the time we get to 21, we're like 90 or 85% water. By the time we get to 60, we're 70% water. So, and then it, of course, it keeps going down from there. But yes, and people are screaming this from the rooftops, and people in politics need to understand, because our power is not in just, you know, we have to make changes, but we need to understand why we need to make changes, how these changes will benefit us, versus just saying we need to make changes. No, you need to see the big picture. See, that's what's missing. In politics, they keep looking at everything in a vacuum. Like, this is the only benefit. If we change this physical law, then your physical life will change this way. No, people need to understand that there is a continuum, and your physical reality is at the very last outcome, the very last end result. So if we need to change has to begin within.
Agreed. And with our last 7 minutes here, I want to read to you what some psychologists say. They say that these attacks can be prevented because they are often planned weeks or months in advance. And the keys to prevention are to spot the earliest behavioral signs that a student is struggling, and also to watch for signs that some may be veering toward violence. So do you think that with more eyes on these kids at school that we would be able to see some of the disruptances? And how do you distinguish regular teenage disruptance to, I'm going to go on a spree? Because some of them look the same. They put on the dark clothes, they get into the goth, you know, and some of them are very peaceful still, and then others will slip to this other side.
It's the same as when we were talking about making changes. You grassroots. We're talking about having more eyes on them. You can't just be looking at them. You have to engage with them. You can have students dress in all black, the gothic, and then have a very spirited personality. You're not overly concerned about that person. You know, healthcare professionals, especially mental healthcare professionals, they're trained to look for certain things. You know, like when you take tests, they'll ask you the same question 10 different ways, basically, so that they can understand your perceptions. You know what I'm saying? Which one of these questions registered with you? Which language registered with you? So you have to engage. Because if you run into another student who dresses in all black and he's morbid and he looks like that he could harm himself, if they look like they can harm themselves, and when I say look like, I'm not talking about just look. I'm talking about when you engage with them, when you connect, when you understand their energy. So these are not your average healthcare professionals. I don't want people who are just looking for a bump in their salary. These have to be people that are sensitive, I mean highly trained, you know, but sensitive to to what to look for, you know, signs and understanding. So it's not just the psychology itself. There has to be some energy work involved. You know what I mean? We have to be more sensitive to our total being and not just one aspect of it. Because and you are a great example. You do healing energy work. So you know how people's energy, I tell people all the time, you can't hide your energy. You know what I mean? You can lie, you can put on your game face, but you can't manipulate your energy to feel one way, you know what I'm saying, when you don't truly feel that way. Because that's basically why things don't get manifested, because there's a conflict between the conscious and the subconscious.
Is it Buddha who says there's three things that can't be hidden for long, the sun, the moon, and the truth, or something like that?
There you go. Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. I like that.
I think it was Buddha. Someone cool said that. And then I just want to finish off this last little piece that I wrote down because I thought it was interesting, kind of going along with what the psychologists are saying. Psychologists say time and time again, psychologists and educators, time and time again, we found that surrounding a young person with the right kind of support and supervision early on can turn most away from violence, which is just kind of supporting what we were saying all along, where you got to get this grassroots movement to get this root support and just let it flow up into the flower.
Yes. I mean, and we need to start, I guess, you know, volunteering. You know what I mean? Because the first thing we think of is when we think of change is how much is it going to cost? And as spiritual beings, we should never be entertaining that thought at all.
Work with what we got.
Because where there's a will, there is a way.
Just takes coordination, organization, and some grassroots efforts.
And focused energy. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, that's the other one, intention, focused energy, idea, a goal, like an outcome that you're interested in. And I feel like, and we only have a few minutes here, and this is a whole other show, but I feel like we're getting to that point. You know, we had a nice little burst in the 60s with the protesters, and you see other countries doing it all the time, taking to the streets. You know, France and other places in Europe. I'd like to take to the streets too.
But the beauty of it now in the age that we live, yes, you can have the people who do want to take it to the streets, but you can also have silent protesters through online. What's the thing that you get people to sign? Petitions. Through online petitions, you can get people to cooperate, to be supportive, to add to the momentum and the energy. And see, it's even more beautiful because you have people who, for one reason or another, may not want to protest publicly or physically. You know what I'm saying?
Maybe they can't. Maybe they're handicapped and they can't get out very often.
Mm-hmm. And for whatever reason, we don't even have to justify it because that's your right. You know what I'm saying? You have the right to choose to do it however you choose to. Let's just provide different avenues for people to support. You know, let's just provide different avenues. Some people may not want to give a signature. Hey, you might want to give anonymous.
Donation. I think we lost you there.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
Yeah. No, it's cool. We got you back now. But yes, I think that, you know, you can do it any way you want. And I think that that's the beauty of assisting and helping, is that whatever speaks to you and however you want to do it. And that might change over the years, where before I'd be more willing to donate money. Now I'm willing to maybe volunteer the time where I have a little more of it now. And that changes throughout your life. And that's why you'll see those old hippies out there with their signs, because they're used to doing it. That's how they like to do it. It reminds them of the way they've always done it, and that's cool. If that's them, then we'll get the millennials at the computers pushing that agenda, pushing that energy. It takes us all. It takes all different kinds. God is blessed that we're all so different. Sonia, I appreciate you today, and I just can't wait till the next time we can get into this topic. I think we will go into part two. We said before we started the show that this is a very, very big topic, and we might need to allot it a couple shows just to get to the bottom of it here. So I appreciate all of our listeners. We should be here maybe not next Saturday, but one of the following Saturdays. You can find Sonia Spirit on Facebook as well as Jenny McDaniel on Facebook. And we are also part of the Heart Over Ego Radio. So you can find us on Facebook. And Sonia, do you want to real quickly get an email address out in case people have some questions for you?
One for all is love, O-N-E, the number 4-A-L-L-I-S-L-O-V-E @gmail.com. One for all is love @gmail.com.
And you can find me at heartoverego@gmail.com. This is Jenny McDaniel signing off with Sonia Spirit, and we look forward to catching up with you later. Thanks, Sonia.
Thank you. Have a great weekend.
You too.